What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
The seacoast in Ireland draws visitors with its natural beauty. It has also become a popular entry point into Europe for cocaine traffickers.
It's a paradise for tourists, really, but it's also a paradise for drug smuggling.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. More about the flow of cocaine into Europe. Also, as Washington turns up the pressure on the government in Venezuela, we'll hear what Venezuelans are thinking.
The question on everybody's lips is, well, what do you think? What's going to happen? I mean, are they going to invade?
Also, today marks 2 years since the Hamas attack on Israel, a day that changed the way many Israelis think.
It made me just feel like, wow, I want to protect us and I want to do it in as moral way as possible. But boy, my priorities become protecting us.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. Solar power is renewable, it is cheap, and it is more popular than ever.
So much so that solar appears to be reshaping the global energy mix. New research finds that for the first time ever, renewable sources of energy, primarily solar, now provide more electricity globally than coal. What's driving this change is the focus of today's Big Fix, our series on climate change solutions. Raul Miranda is with a climate think tank in the UK called Ember, which carried out that research. He spoke with us earlier today from Rio de Janeiro.
For more than a century, coal and gas were the backbone of progress, so they powered industries and cities. But now, for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, the growth of electricity is coming from clean sources instead of fossil ones.
What would you say are the factors that are driving this trend?
I mean, the short answer will be, you know, technology, the cost and momentum. And solar and wind have become the cheapest forms of new power in most parts of the world. And every new project sort of makes the next one cheaper, creating an interesting cycle of growth. While with fossil fuels, essentially you have a stable cost, or at least actually even increasing cost, because the more you extract fossil fuels from the ground, the more expensive they become. So you have different trends in terms of cost, you know, one going down while the other tend to go up.
Where is this shift to renewable energy happening the most dramatically, and what parts of the world still rely heavily on fossil fuels for power?
Yes, and most of this growth has been observed in the most emerging and common. We have China and India as main ones. You know, we've seen in these two countries, you know, solar really outpacing fossil fuel and particularly coal generation. But that's not only a story for China and India. We've seen the same in Brazil. We've seen the same in Southeast Asia, Pakistan. So there has been really a global momentum and a global movement towards renewables and having renewables being cheaper and outpacing fossil fuel generation.
I mean, you mentioned the technology. I mean, China is the world's largest producer of solar panels, and I'm guessing that gives them significant home production advantage. But specifically in China and India, what's happening in those countries that explains these changes?
China led global clean energy growth in the first semester of this year, so adding more solar and wind power than the rest of the world combined, so essentially cutting fossil fuel generation in that country. And the fossil fuel use in China is sort of, you know, starting to achieve a plateau. In India, the clean growth outpaced demand by more than three times, which means that the new renewable generation outpaced also the new increase in demand. By outpacing demand, that means that you now have renewables also being able to, you know, fill in the electricity generation that once was met by fossil fuels.
I'm curious, with this embrace of renewables in China and India, are they also still burning coal, but just at a reduced rate?
Yes, that's correct. Even if you see eventually that in some countries, you eventually see that they are still, you know, building new coal generation, that means that some of this new coal, they are essentially being used for fewer moments in the year, but not at a flat, stable generation across the year.
What about the economic alarm bells that the renewable cynics have been warning about, that renewables cannot provide the same robust energy for industrial production that fossil fuels can? Have China and India proven them wrong?
Solar and renewables generally have proven that we do have all the technologies needed for, you know, essentially having a stable generation, a flat generation. So things like storage, things like, exchanging electricity across a continental grid, and even having some pitch-in and response from demand in terms of trying to tailor to that availability of electricity. Countries like China and India, they do manage to make it eventually better than some other countries. We see that in the Western side, there has been, you know, some development of grids, for instance, that have been lagging a bit. So what you see there is a long queue for connecting solar and wind facilities, which means that essentially you are a bit getting some of these projects. You have the investors there. You have the investors willing to connect, but they just can't be connected onto the grid. While in China, perhaps that's not the case.
Some countries are slowing down or even walking back efforts to cut back on the carbon emissions that drive climate change. In fact, in both the U.S. and Europe, fossil fuel use actually increased. So do you think this recent rise in renewables is going to continue, or is it just a blip in the bigger story?
Yeah, specifically in the U.S., solar and wind indeed couldn't keep up that rise in electricity demand in that country. So essentially coal stepped up to fill in that gap. In the EU, we had last year and also this year weaker wind and hydro, which meant that gas and coal generation had to rise again, ultimately leading again to the slight increase in emissions. So we have different stories in these two countries and Europe, but generally the storyline is the same. These countries have been increasing solar and wind, but they've been also eventually facing some challenges in doing so. We may still see, you know, these moments where fossil fuels may eventually still increase, but the overall global trend, it goes in the opposite direction, actually fossil fuels going down.
What is the rise in electricity demand in the U.S. about? Is it clear?
That's something that we, in our report, we haven't tapped on precisely. We do see that in some parts of the globe, for instance, to take the example of India, we did see an increase in electricity demand due to heat waves. And then you can attach to that also the industrial activity in that country. And at the same time, when we are thinking about, you know, going towards, 2030, 35, and 2040, we should also add on this puzzle electrification, right? We are essentially in a movement of electrifying our end users and electrifying transports with electric vehicles. We are seeing an increase in data center demand. We are seeing an increase perhaps in those, in some specific countries, of heat pumps. So there is also a trend of having some of these end users being electrified, also in industries with a heat, low temperature heat supply. So all of these naturally will increase electricity. So that's, again, a general trend across countries, but they are also in different, I would say, at different stages of this electrification pace, right? Electrification is also moving forward, but it's also uneven between countries.
Raul Miranda is with the climate think tank Ember. He spoke today with us from Rio de Janeiro. In Europe, cocaine use has soared over the past decade. The drug is usually moved in large container ships from South America and then smuggled into European ports in Germany, the Netherlands, and Spain. But traffickers are now setting their sights on another part of the continent. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, reports.
In July this year, 8 men were jailed for what turned out to be the largest ever cocaine smuggling operation off Ireland's coast. The 8 had been part of an international crew on board a cargo ship called the MV Matthew that had set sail from Venezuela 2 years ago, carrying cocaine worth an estimated street value of more than $180 million. Even before the vessel had entered Irish waters, local customs officials had received a tip-off.
MV Matthew, this is Irish Customs. Irish Customs, how do you read?
This is MV Matthew. Please repeat who is calling.
MV Matthew, this is Irish Patrol, Papa 63, on your starboard side.
In a series of audio messages released by the Irish authorities, the naval official can be heard instructing the vessel to pull into Cork Harbour.
We're requesting you to alter your course immediately to starboard, on a safe course and more direct route to Cork. Over.
The cargo ship ignores the instruction and turns back towards international waters. Sometime later, the Irish authorities fire a warning shot. And then another one.
I will now issue a second warning shot. Do you understand? Over.
Why you are firing at us? Please do not kill us. Please do not endanger our safety. What law applicable? Over.
MV Matthew, the United Nations law or convention on the law of the sea applies. We are in hot pursuit. You will not comply with my orders. I will now issue a further warning shot.
This exchange continues for several more hours. Eventually, like a scene from an action movie, Army Rangers descend from a helicopter using ropes, jump onto the cargo ship and seize the crew. The operation was seen as a triumph for the Irish authorities and international law enforcement.
This investigation dismantled a significant international criminal group. It kept 157 million euros worth of cocaine off our streets and out of the pockets of organised crime.
David Conter is a director with Interpol. An Irish police chief said it showed the country was not a soft target for international drug smugglers. But not everyone in Ireland sees it that way.
The reality is this is a major soft touch. Everybody knows it.
Cathal Berry is a former Irish Army commandant.
It's a playground for cartels, and we would say that we've handed the keys of the country over to the cartels, really.
Ireland got lucky that day, he says, but it's not usually like that. The naval service has 8 ships, but can usually only put 2 out to sea at any one time, he says, because of a lack of crew. And Ireland's coastline, with its hundreds of small, isolated inlets, makes it an ideal dropping-off point for traffickers.
It's a paradise for tourists, really, geographically, but it's also a paradise for drug smuggling, because it's very, very difficult to police those waters.
The country has the lowest defence spending in all of the EU, and Berry says that's got to change. But other EU countries with far higher defence budgets are also struggling to tackle the problem.
It is very hard to disrupt cocaine trafficking because Europe is a very geographically, let's say, fragmented and also open continent.
Daniel Brombacher runs the Europe Bureau of the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime.
So as compared, for example, to the North American market, you have basically between Mexico and the US, you have just one border and you have certain entry points. But in Europe, you have many different entry points.
There have been some success stories, Brombacher says. Antwerp, Rotterdam and Hamburg, the 3 largest ports in Europe, have all seen a massive increase in cocaine seizures in the last few years, he says. The only problem is smugglers have just headed elsewhere in the bloc.
So, for example, now you can see cocaine seizures on the Baltic Sea. Traditionally, there was never any cocaine trafficking on the Baltic Sea. Then you have an increase again in Spain. You can see France receives a lot of cocaine. You can see the Western Balkans and the southeastern European routes.
The only way European countries can hope to combat the problem, he says, is if they join forces. Other experts aren't so sure the answer lies with law enforcement.
I mean, what is actually seized is a reflection of law enforcement activity. It's not a reflection of what is available in terms of drugs.
Johnny Connolly is a criminologist based at the University of Limerick. EU reports show that less than 1 in 10 drugs on the market are intercepted. And Connolly says studies have shown that you'd need to seize more than 80% to really make a dent. No government has come close to that, he says, except maybe the Taliban in Afghanistan. It might be time to rethink our strategy by focusing on reducing demand, he says.
If we go down a different legal approach, then should more resources go into education and prevention and health interventions and harm reduction, etc.
And maybe consider legalising some of these drugs. Connolly admits that might be a step too far for many European governments. But something has to change, he says, because what we're doing now clearly isn't working. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Just ahead, U.S. pressure on Venezuela from a Venezuelan perspective. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Deadly strikes by the U.S. military off the coast of Venezuela are raising fears on shore. At least four boats have been destroyed in strikes that President Trump says are meant to prevent traffickers from sending illegal drugs into the United States. But U.S. officials also called the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, an illegitimate leader. With a fleet of American warships in the Southern Caribbean, there's speculation about an escalation of U.S. military activity against Venezuela. Phil Gunson is a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group based in Caracas, the Venezuelan capital. I asked him what he's hearing from people in Venezuela about these rising tensions with the U.S.
If you were to parachute into Caracas any day of the week, most of the time you wouldn't even know if you weren't previously warned that there was anything going on at all. I mean, life goes on as normal. Of course, there's a wide variety of reactions. You know, some people are, you know, looking forward to a U.S. intervention, believing that at any moment the Maduro government could fall. Others, of course, are fearful of what might happen and the violence that might ensue, especially if they're on the government side. And a lot of people in the middle are just really confused. There's a lack of information. People are wondering, you know, what is really going on.
Are people seeming fearful for their own future safety?
I don't think most people know. I mean, there's a degree of nervousness, yes, but it's mostly confusion. I mean, as one goes around, especially those of us who are supposed to know what's going on, the question on everybody's lips is, well, what do you think? What's going to happen? I mean, are they going to invade? Or are they just going to go away? Is it another bluff? So really, that's, I think, the prevailing atmosphere.
What is the Maduro government saying about these escalating tensions?
Well, they began, you know, when the first boat was blown up, the government's initial reaction, the president's initial reaction was really to say nothing. They sent out a deputy information minister to say that the incident never happened. The video was created by artificial intelligence. They maintained that line for about a week, which I think tells us that they really don't want any kind of escalation. You know, the government, the military here, the armed forces are not in a position to resist the kind of force that the U.S. has arrayed. But of course, then there's the revolutionary rhetoric. This is imperialist aggression. And I suppose there's been a number of different attempts by Maduro to say, quite publicly, you know, we want to sit down and talk to the Trump administration. We believe this is all being driven by Secretary of State Rubio. We can make a deal. But they're, you know, they're clearly on the defensive.
I have read that people in the fishing industry in countries like Trinidad and Tobago, which is not far offshore of Venezuela, are increasingly fearful that their fishing boats might be mistaken as drug boats and they might be in danger. I can't imagine it's much different for Venezuelans who make their living on the sea.
Well, that's right. You know, certainly there's nervousness. But at the same time, of course, the fishermen on that stretch of coast where the first boats they left from in northeast Venezuela, not far, as you say, from Trinidad, you know, they really don't have much choice. Inshore fishermen at least are continuing to fish because if they don't fish, then they don't eat. So they have to go out and they have to just hope that the U.S. drones or whatever it is they've got up there, whatever surveillance there is, are capable of telling the difference between a go-fast drug boat and a fishing boat, which so far they appear to have been able to do.
The White House says that these boats the U.S. military has attacked belong to, quote, narco-terrorists. What evidence have you seen about this?
Well, there's no narco-terrorist cartel called the Cartel of the Suns, as the U.S. government would have us believe. There's a permissive atmosphere. You know, the government allows basically most people, military officers, to engage in this kind of business because they really don't have enough money to pay them anyway. They need to keep military loyalty. But there's no evidence of this massive terrorist conspiracy that drugs are somehow being sent to the United States in order to undermine the government, or that Tren de Aragua, you know, this criminal group that Maduro is supposed to lead, you know, is being sent there to sow mayhem in the U.S. This is all, I think, vastly exaggerated, rather cartoonish.
But the actual boats that have been struck, is there evidence that they were transporting drugs?
Well, the boats, of course, because they were blown up, with the exception of one where the drugs, in fact, were captured off the Dominican Republic, the drug boats or alleged drug boats that have been blown up here, they end up in a lot of small pieces. So I don't think any evidence was collected from that. It's a fair assumption that they quite probably were carrying drugs. But of course, even if they were, summary execution is not the legal way to proceed.
The Trump administration is calling Maduro himself a narco-terrorist. Is he upping security around himself?
He's taken a few measures that I think are probably linked to the current situation. For example, when he does emerge in public, when he has public engagements, he tends to make sure that he's surrounded by lots of civilians, at least lots of people who would be collateral damage if there were any attempt to kill him, to target him, particularly with a bomb or a rocket. But other than that, government business goes on as usual. Of course, they're mobilizing. I mean, they've mobilized the militia, they've mobilized the armed forces, both onshore and offshore. But as I say, there's not a lot that they can do because the Venezuelan armed forces are not, the military balance is weighted very heavily in favor of the U.S. lead.
There is talk that, U.S. forces might be coming in to overthrow the Maduro government, right? Where is that talk coming from and how widespread is the belief that that might happen?
Well, it's really coming directly from Washington. I mean, if you look at statements even from the White House podium by Caroline Leavitt, she's saying quite explicitly, Maduro is a fugitive drug trafficker and we're going to bring him to justice. Off the record, lots of people in the administration have been saying that, they want to get rid of Maduro. That's been a long-standing aim of Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, in particular. But of course, there's a number of different objectives combined here. Partly it is an operation against drug trafficking. There are other interests. Obviously, there are energy interests. There's the interest of the Trump administration in ensuring that migrants continue to return to Venezuela, which may operate to a degree against the prevailing trend in the sense that military action might interrupt that. There's a lot of different things going on. They want to keep the Chinese out or reduce Chinese influence in the region. So, to some extent, these objectives are operating at cross purposes. It's not clear that they can achieve all the things they want to achieve, or indeed any of them.
And I think you mentioned that Venezuelans were maybe a bit divided on these whispers about regime change. Supporters of Maduro would be afraid of it, and people who don't support him would be happy about it. Is that about right?
That's right. There's certainly people here who can't wait for the Marines to land. And equally, there are people who feel that if there were a sudden regime change, then, their lives would be totally disrupted. People at the top obviously fear jail or even death, and certainly the loss of power, loss of wealth. But people lower down the chain as well on the government side fear that if, for example, like Corina Machado, the opposition leader, were to come to power, then there might well be a wave of revenge, basically. Again, this is a 26-year crisis in which a lot of people have built up tremendous resentment. So people are scared. They may only lose their jobs, but there's clearly fear that it might be worse than that.
Phil Gunson is a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group based in Caracas, the Venezuelan capital. More global stories are coming your way. You are with The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. For the people who lived through it, the memories are still vivid 2 years later. On October 7th, 2023, Hamas gunmen in the Gaza Strip attacked communities in southern Israel. The fallout has shaken the globe.
It's led to a war between Israel and Iran, between Israel and Lebanon, and an unending war in the Gaza Strip. An Israeli military campaign has left the coastal enclave in ruins. The official death toll, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, 67,000 and counting.
Ghassan Abu Rajela is a Palestinian father who was displaced from his home to the city of Khan Yunis. He told the Associated Press today, "We've lost the beautiful moments, and our life has become hell."
For 2 years, we follow the contours of the story. Today and tomorrow, we're hearing how individual lives have changed, starting with Susan Silverman. She lives in Jerusalem, where she directs an organization called Second Nurture that works with foster families. Silverman is an author, activist, mother of five, and a Reform rabbi. We spoke 2 years ago in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, and when we checked back in on this anniversary, I asked where her mind was at now.
Oh, gosh. My mind is always, I think, for the past 2 years in like so many different places. And I think that, you know, when we're in a situation like we're in, it can get very spinny, right? Like we're over and all, like we can't stop thinking about the hostages, right? We can't stop thinking about all the risk we're in. You know, I mean, Israel has never had a break, right? In our entire existence, there's always been people trying to destroy us, right? I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's just been our story. And sometimes we can live with that kind of like a veil where we can kind of not think about that reality that's all around us all the time. And the past 2 years has been just raw, you know, just raw.
I mean, that was the word you used when we last spoke. You described how people you knew felt raw and also broken. So 2 years later, how have those feelings evolved or have they?
You know, I'm American and Israeli, right? So I kind of like am in both worlds. And so kind of I've been on one level, I'm, you know, within Israel, like many, many people that I know have been protesting our government. I mean, before the war, we're protesting our government. After the war, we're protesting our government. You know, we're on the streets when, you know, if any war is justified, this one was, until it was hijacked by our extremists. And then we were all on the streets to stop the war. So there's that one level going on all the time where as Israelis, we are Israelis and we need to make our country better. Right. We need to work toward that within the country. But then all of the hatred around the world toward us is another level. Right. So when I'm thinking about or experiencing people's perceptions outside of Israel about Israel, I feel like more and more, I feel like the hubris of that kind of conversation. Right. And it kind of like, I don't know, it kind of like hit me hard when I saw this interview with Stephen Colbert and Zohran Mamdani. And Colbert said to Mamdani,
the mayoral candidate in New York City.
Exactly, yes. And said, does Israel have a right to exist? And Mamdani just said, yes, like as a country that observes international law. And all of a sudden, everything was distilled for me from the perspective of outside of Israel, right? Which is, wow, people actually think they get to decide if we exist or not, or have an opinion if we exist or not. It's sort of like, can you imagine any other country being asked the right to exist? You might oppose what they do. You might think that they're a bad country. You might think all these things. But the question is like such an essential, like as in like crucial question that is like, do Jews have a right to exist? And it's been asked wherever we've lived, right? And so I think I've become like from someone who has, I would say pretty much open-hearted, someone who's just like cynical and I don't trust the world. You know, if you're asking about like me, and I feel like that's true for a lot of people around me, like kind of like don't trust the world in a way that we did before.
Isn't this the same issue for the Palestinian people, that the existence of their country is constantly in question?
Well, there should be a Palestinian state, and I completely agree with that. I think it doesn't exist right now, right? Israel is a country that from its beginning, from before there is even like a desire for a Palestinian state, right? When it was when the other countries were Jordan and Egypt, you know, around them, like it wasn't this like mad desire for a Palestinian state. Now there should be, but it doesn't exist right now. Like once it exists, nobody should say, does it have a right to exist? Because it exists, it's a country. I mean, there are so many countries that are in that same kind of battle with, you know, independence and parts of the region that want to be separate. And nobody questions the existence of the existing country, right? Does India have a right to exist? Does Pakistan have a right to exist? Like, once it exists, nobody asks anymore. And it's only kind of here that these questions even come up, like around us. And the question about Jews existing in the world is not a new question.
Can you get back to what you said a moment ago? What do you mean about Israelis working to make Israel better?
What it looks like is working really hard to get rid of the government we have right now. You know, when like Bibi's the least of your problems in the coalition, you know you're really in trouble.
The prime minister, yeah.
Right. Like that. I mean, we have some really, really terrible people in our government, and we have settler terrorists who are abusing their Palestinian neighbors. And now not all by a stretch. It's sort of our version of extreme MAGA, our version of the KKK or something like that lives here. And the problem is that our government is not arresting them. Right. So as Israelis, we need to say we're going to stop this war. As Israelis, we need to say, you know, we need to arrest those people and they need to spend their lives in jail. But from people outside of Israel, where the sins of our country are pretty commensurate or way, way, you know, like less offensive than many, many, many countries in this world, for us to be the country that people feel like they get to decide, like if we have a right to exist or not, you know, we're sort of their thought experiment. We're their thought experiment, not a country. And I've started to just become like completely like go to hell, like about the whole rest of the world in so many ways and be sort of like defensive. But at the same time, we need to make this country internally better.
Rabbi, was there a particular moment or moments over the past 2 years that you kind of see as inflection points when unity in Israeli society gave way to division, or what you were talking about earlier, that trust in the rest of the world really began to dissolve?
Well, it's interesting because I live very much on the left here, right? Like I have very few friends who are outside of that bubble, although I do have some. So we have, I think a lot of us have really felt like we've lost our kind of faith in liberal movements around the world. We've lost our faith that other people have our backs. I mean, it's one thing to ask about the existence of our country. It's another thing to say, hey, we see that you've got a lot of struggles there that you need to overcome. And we care for whatever reason outside of Israel about Israel. How can we help you who are living there to do that? How can we help you to elect a government that's going to be amenable to a Palestinian state? How can we help you to make Israel a more just democracy? And that question's not asked of us who are doing the work on the left. It's just this joy in demonizing us. You know, but if people really cared and wanted to move forward, it would not be demonizing us. It would be partnering with those of us who are doing the work on the ground.
Your definition of the left in Israel, though, is not as left as many Jews around the world see it. I mean, there are so many Jews who have questioned what Israel is doing and, by extension, what support of Israel means today. How do you dialogue with those people?
I really don't. Like, a friend of mine, right after the 7th, when I felt like, how do we even go on in the world? She said, we put our energy in what we know to be true. And that was really, really powerful for me. Now, I run an organization that's based in the U.S. that works with foster families, right? It's foster families across the country and really strengthening those families and making stability for kids. And I know to be true that kids need love and stability. And so I was able to say, okay, like my work, that's what I put the energy because I know that to be true. And that was really, really helpful because we didn't know what was true anymore. We didn't know what was real anymore. But the things that we do know to be true, that's what we can put our energy into and focus on. But I think for a lot of people, we are like a vessel that you can kind of put all evil in, purifying themselves, you know, and being able to point at us as the evil and themselves as pure. And what it does is it makes people not have to focus on the sins around them, where they live, what they're doing, the actual real work of making the world better, can just kind of like be in an encampment and point to Israel and be all righteous. You know, it's extremely performative and infuriating for those of us who are living here and whose kids are serving in the army, regardless of our feelings about what the army's doing, because we have reality to deal with, right? We don't get to sit on a campus and demand humanitarian aid as we take over a building, you know, like the absurdity of it.
I'm speaking with Rabbi Susan Silverman, a Reform rabbi in Jerusalem, on the second anniversary of the Hamas attacks on Israel. I mean, this stuff that's happening in the outside world, I'm really curious. I mean, as a mother of five, have there been times in the past 2 years where you've been surprised by your children's responses or reactions to what's been happening?
Yeah, very much so. And it's interesting because for a lot of us, our kids are more kind of hawkish than we are.
And how old is your oldest and youngest?
My oldest is 32. She's actually extremely left. She lives in Tel Aviv and is very, very left. And our youngest is 22. And she's more center. I mean, none of her kids are like right wing, but, you know, more center and sort of more what they would say is like real and practical. You know, we have very, very real threats to our existence. And, you know, the United States killed 450,000 people after 9/11, you know, the United States and its allies, right? And nobody seemed to blink an eye, it felt like.
There was also President Biden who, right after October 7th, warned the Israeli prime minister of the mistakes that the United States had made after 9/11. But evidently, the prime minister did not take heed.
Well, although the prime minister is concerned with the prime minister.
Back to your children. Are there conversations you found yourself having with them that you never expected to?
Well, it's interesting because our son, Adar, is now 26. And when he was in the army, he was in combat, and this is before October 7th. And I remember saying to him, like, he was on the Gaza border. I'm like, sweetie, I heard someone was shot in Gaza from, you know, an Israeli soldier. What's the story? Why? And he goes, Mom, there are thousands of people at the gate screaming death to the Jews. If the person with the razor cutter cuts through and gets in, there will be thousands of deaths, of course, years before October 7th. And I was like, wow, I don't know. It seemed kind of extreme to me to have to shoot somebody, you know. And now you're like, wow, people really did. People, it's true, really want to see death to all Jews. And we're up against people around us who want to see that. Like, it's real. And, you know, so we're in this position of, like, not wanting to kill innocent people and being in a position of, like, the people who want to kill us hiding behind them. And it's just very hard. Now, I'm with a lot of the world that I want this war to end now. Although it's interesting, I've seen like a bunch of stuff online of people who are anti-Israel saying, you can't tell us to stop now. I'm like, you've been calling for a ceasefire for 2 years. Like, what does that mean to you, actually? It just means like we should die. And it's really that feeling now. And it's a terrible, terrible position.
Rabbi, what does moving forward look like to you?
Moving forward looks like doing the real work on the ground here, getting rid of this government, electing a sane government that's going to move forward, that's going to increase the good of our democracy here, And it's just the real work on the ground. We're holding like house parties for, you know, the more left-wing parties here and for Arab parties at our house and trying to get people to know about it. And just like taking real steps that will hopefully move us forward and away from this right-wing crazy ass government and into a sane and a democratically oriented government.
Going back to the impact on Jews around the globe, it's hard to say cause and effect, but it appears that anti-Semitism around the world has increased because of Israel's actions in Gaza. Do you worry that the entire project of Israel has become a liability for Jews?
No. I mean, listen, it's funny because there were Jews writing to me and saying basically, why is Israel doing this? Why is Israel doing that? And I basically said to them, listen, you're uncomfortable being an American Jew because you don't like what Israel's doing or people don't like it. But I mean, you know, I hear that there was anti-Semitism before Israel. Like I hear rumors that Jews were not particularly loved around the world and were scapegoated constantly in Europe and Africa and Middle Eastern countries. Like we were scapegoated everywhere. And Israel, oh, wow, this gave it, maybe it handed people an easier way to say, like, we hate Jews, but we know we can't say we hate Jews anymore. So we'll just say it differently now. But no, I mean, if anything, it's like the necessity of a Jewish state is more stark to me than ever.
I just want to ask you just like straight up, what do you think is a headline about how the past 2 years has changed you as a Jew?
I was very much into kind of like the prophetic Judaism of like, let's change the world. And now I feel like, okay, let's make us as good as we can, but also as strong as we can. I believe much more strongly now than I used to in our rights to protect ourselves. I think I just, you know, I didn't know well enough what it really means to be attacked and for people around us to really, really want to kill us. This giant thing, it made me just feel like, wow, I want to protect us and I want to do it in as moral way as possible. But boy, my priorities become protecting us. It shifted. And a lot of resentment toward people who make choices that protect themselves all the time and deny that to us.
Where do you look for hope these days? I've heard kind of vestiges of hope throughout this conversation, but what's your North Star?
So listen, this is something that our rabbi really did for us in the congregation where we go here in Jerusalem, the Reform congregation, is that even right after the 7th, he was really able to help us see like the threads, the gossamer thin threads of holiness around us. Like we couldn't see them anywhere. It was too dark. They were too pale. It just wasn't possible. But he really helped us lift our eyes to what is there. And so I do that with Jewish tradition, with holidays, with lives, with relationships with each other, just trying to see that those threads of holiness are still around and that we can still, we have it in us to brighten them and strengthen them. And so that's very much a focus of mine, is where do we see those threads? How can we discern them in this darkness? And how do we make them brighter and stronger?
Rabbi Susan Silverman lives in Jerusalem, where she's an author, teacher, activist, and mother of five. Rabbi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you so much.
Susan Silverman reflecting on the anniversary of the October 7th Hamas attack in Israel. Of course, we know that for people in Gaza, these last 2 years have brought human suffering on a catastrophic scale.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from a Palestinian father there about what he's experienced and what it would mean for his family to leave the place they call home.
The decision is very difficult. Like you take your soul out of your body. We know if we leave Gaza, we will not back to Gaza again.
Join us for that conversation tomorrow. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Over the weekend, weather balloons from Belarus disrupted flights across the border in Lithuania's capital. The airport in Vilnius was closed down for hours. Now, these balloons were not being used for meteorological purposes. They were loaded with contraband cigarettes and sent by smugglers.
Lithuania's border guard said at least 11 balloons were involved and that they seized 18,000 packs of black market cigarettes. The airport shutdown delayed several thousand travelers. It appears that this is not a one-off. So far this year, more than 500 balloons have been recorded entering Lithuania from Belarus. A government spokesman said the number could be even higher. At least, he said, they're not using drones. The balloons are much easier to stop.
In the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh, elephants driven out of their native habitats have been coming into contact for the first time with humans. People there both fear and revere the giant animals suddenly living in their midst.
Yesterday, we heard about the community of Chittoor, where elephant-human contact has been catastrophic, even deadly. Today, we travel to the Bay of Bengal, 600 miles away, where a different elephant herd is moving in. And the humans there, not having much of a choice, are finding ways to live with the chaos. Namrata Kolachlam traveled to the Bay of Bengal to see for herself.
On the gently rolling plains of Parvathipuram, I pushed through rows of cotton, rice, and corn, all sold in nearby cities along the Bay of Bengal, when suddenly I see three elephants standing in the middle of a cornfield. They alternate chewing on the sweet corn and tossing dust and plant stalks onto their back to protect from the sun's rays. Srinivas Rao, who planted the corn, watches with frustration. Months of his hard labor are destroyed in a matter of hours. He explains that this happens to farmers over and over. He pleads, "What are we supposed to do? Tell me." This herd of nine elephants arrived in 2017 after the state to the north, Odisha, intensified its mining practices. The state's quest for iron ore destroyed much of the elephants' traditional habitats, so they fled mining territory. But they're arriving in a region with almost no forests, which means elephants spend almost all their time in the crop fields. For them, it's an all-you-can-eat buffet. But for the people here, it's far more stressful. On the day I visit, villagers plead with forest department officials to set off firecrackers to scare the elephants from their fields. Officials use small explosives in other parts of the state, but a forest department official explains it wouldn't help things here. It might even make things worse. He's telling people, okay, you can use them, but the elephants will get more aggressive and make things even harder for you. Loud sounds agitate elephants. And without forests to run to, they might not only destroy more crops, they could even harm or kill villagers. To prevent casualties, an elephant monitoring team tracks the herd 24 hours a day. Statewide, the government has also tried erecting electric fences and digging trenches to keep elephants away. But elephants are very smart. Forest Department officials show me videos of elephants precisely using their non-conductive tusks to pull down electric fences, or working in teams to fill trenches with mud so they can continue on their route. Minimizing conflict with this intelligent species may get even tougher due to climate change. Venkata Sarachandra, a public health researcher, says 80 to 90% of the state borders the Bay of Bengal.
Because of the influence of the humidity which comes up from the oceans, we have more intense heat effect.
He tells me that rising heat and humidity are becoming dangerous along the coastline. And as that happens, invasive plant species could take over degraded forests.
The proliferation of exotic invasive species may not be palatable for elephants.
That's wildlife biologist Dr. B. Ramakrishnan explaining that the changing plant life in forests would be just one more reason for elephants to head to farmland. And that's not all. There are also more forest fires. The combination of hotter days, threadbare tree canopies, and the risk of drought means that one lightning strike on a pile of dry leaves could wipe out even more of an elephant's diet. In 2024, Andhra Pradesh had the highest number of forest fires in India.
The fire incidences, that's also one of the climatic factors that will devastate the natural vegetation.
Between mining, deforestation, and climate change, elephants have far fewer places to turn. back in Parvathipuram, where I saw three elephants eating corn. This means some females have even given birth in crop fields. Crops are the only food these young elephants have known. Even if government officials manage to drive them back towards forest land, they might not have the foraging skills to survive there. In a village in the coastal district of Shikakalam, a group of young men hang out together under some shade. One farmer says he's sympathetic to the elephant's plight.
Sufficient food, water facilities.
There's sufficient food, water facilities, and nice places to rest here, he says. Still, everyone is exhausted from living so near a herd of four elephants, also from Odisha. The herd spends half the year in these fields, and that's been happening for the last 5 years. One man, Praveen, tells me that their daily lives revolve around managing the dangers that elephants pose. After 4 p.m., you have to be so careful, he says. You have to look this way, look that way, call the officials. He shows me a WhatsApp group called Four Elephants Information. They use it to ping each other throughout the day, alerting loved ones to the elephants' whereabouts. Praveen says they all have the direct number of Forest Department officials, who are more like friendly uncles at this point. They've become like family members now, after 5 years, he says. In different areas of the state, experts have proposed using trained elephants to control the wild herds, imposing a crop holiday to make farms less appealing, or even trying to capture disruptive elephants. But for now, farmers and elephants continue their uneasy coexistence against a backdrop of dwindling forests and rising temperatures. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam, northeastern Andhra Pradesh.
Namrata followed elephants on the move in India with support from the Internews Earth Journalism Network.
And that puts a wrap on today's show. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find us online at theworld.org. We've got a new YouTube channel where you will find lots more original reporting. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Jan Elizabeth, Jane Johnson, Kira and Peter McGrath, Leslie Meadowcroft, Maggie Walker, Ravi Mohan, and Rich Gorlick. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.